Good evening and welcome to Dialysis Talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight we are rebroadcasting one of our past shows, How to Ask for What You Want with John Ryder. John discusses how patients can empower themselves and take charge of their own treatment. His insight will help listeners process the difficulties faced by dialysis patients and their families. John presently works with outpatients at High Point Treatment Center in Roxton, Massachusetts. Your on-air host tonight will be Arlene Tinker.
Honored to have you as a guest tonight. I've known you for years. I think it was right after our Senate hearing when I would call and didn't know what I was doing. And you always had time to dust me off and put me on the path. And you always had time to talk to me and tell me it would be okay. And for that, I have always been grateful. You honestly have helped me a lot. I am going to go in a little bit about you. So if you could give us a brief synopsis of what you have accomplished, which is not brief at all.
Well, so I would say that, first of all, anything I've done has been done on the shoulders of many, many people before me. And like in life as a whole, I think if we're telling the truth about things, the accomplishments any of us does in life are really shared among all those that have helped us to get to be where we're in a position to help out a little bit, right? So I guess really the easiest way to say some of the things I've done, I explained it to somebody the other day in a very simple way. My whole life has been about social justice. And that's the simplest way to say it. But that is because I saw a lot of injustices when I was young, and some injustices were done to me, and I didn't like it. And so I said, well, you can either, just let these things go on, or you could take a stand. And so I felt it was a much better position to take a stand. And so whether it was standing up for people of color in the South, where I saw, very blatant racism, and then North, it's actually was much more covert and in some ways even more dangerous because of that. But when I was a kid, I saw enough of it that it was disgusting to me. And then in my later years, I also was involved in the anti-apartheid movement in my college years, but I saw the effect of what was an increasing militarism in the country, and heard in college that the chances of my being killed in a thermonuclear war was a 50-50. And I said, geez, I don't always get coin tosses right. This is insane. And so I worked as a missionary after college and helped create the largest peace demonstration in U.S. history in June 12, 1982 for the U.N. Special Session on Disarmament. That was coming back from Africa and seeing abject poverty in the Sudan, which is what I did immediately after college. And then I went to seminary and worked more on economic justice by working with the homeless folks and trying to do the best I could to help eliminate homelessness. And that's what I did my master's thesis on in college, and at graduate school, excuse me, and then went from there to working pretty much with people with HIV/AIDS, and in between there doing some teaching. So the time you met me was in that chapter of working with people with HIV/AIDS, which was probably the longest chapter for 15 years. I was a national advocate for a group called the Committee of 10,000. And then most recently I've been working with people with addiction issues, because I feel that every person has value, and that people, whether they're people with disabilities or people who are discriminated against or have people have prejudice against, that we need to work on these things to really lift up the best in all people, and that by doing that, We help the world to be a better place, and we help ourselves to be able to have a good place to live in, just because we're doing the things that make the world a nicer place for everybody. I hope that explains it in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's career-wise. On a personal basis, I'll just say one quick thing. Without my wife and kids and family and friends, none of those things that I've done would have been accomplished. So, and also, truthfully, without my spiritual faith, I would not have been able to sustain what I've sustained. And I really feel that that is those very important supports have enabled me to do the things that I have been able to do.
And it takes a special, right? And I think that it takes a special person to be married to an activist or an advocate.
Yep.
If you have to have the same faith base, are the same things that outrage you, and she must be quite a gal because you're quite a guy.
Yeah.
So,
she is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
30 years married, so I think that's not a bad testimony to say that.
Well, how long did it take her to train you, though, John?
Yeah. Well, she's we marched together in the 80s,
yeah.
So it's not. I mean, it was she had, and she's her work, her career path has been as a social worker, and she has done remarkable work herself. I mean, after 9/11 happened, people in New York, because we lived in New York for a while, knew her skill set and her ability to help people. And she actually was brought back to New York City, even though we were in Massachusetts at the time, to help people go into the buildings that were just around Ground Zero, that they had a severe trauma, obviously, seeing what they saw. So, you know, she was there for a bit and really, you know, is truly gifted in her ability to help people. And she works helping people with hospice, as I did at one point as well. So we both, I think, have gained wisdom.
That's tough.
Well, it's actually hugely, hugely a gift, because when people are sick and they're at the last stages of their life, if you're a privileged listener and you're able to be present, the greatest wisdom that you can receive in life is often given at that time. And it's a huge privilege and honor to be able to receive those gifts from people who are trying to give you the most wisdom that they have received in their lives. So to be a privileged listener and to be able to be present at that kind of intimate time for people is a real blessing for anybody who can do it, so we both share that kind of appreciation of the wisdom of many who've gone beyond, are now in the spirit world, as I would say.
And what do you think is the most important things that they've taught you?
I think the most important things is to don't sweat the small stuff, and to enjoy. Enjoy the opportunities that are before you while you have the chance to do that, and don't hold grudges. I think that's a big thing that many people suffer needlessly because they haven't learned how to forgive. And unfortunately, one of the hardest things for people to learn in life, I think, is the ability to understand that by forgiving someone that may have harmed you or done something wrong to you, that it frees you to be free of a toxin of holding anger and animosity towards that person. And so that the healing is both for yourself and for the other person. So the idea that we have to be negative all the time about things is toxic to both us and to the party we're holding that animosity towards. And it's a losing situation for both when, if we can embrace a forgiving attitude, that's not a forgetting attitude, but a forgiving attitude, I think it actually can help to improve things for both parties and can be a winning situation. So it's a big, you know, having families where, I just came back from a course on families. That's what I've been doing right before this call. And, you know, dysfunctional families are the norm. Let's face it. I can attest to that. Yeah, show me the perfect family. I'd love to see them someday. But it's what we do with that, right, that makes the difference. Mm-hmm. And I think people at the end, they want a sense of peace. They want a sense of being able to be reassured that things will be okay and will be better for those that are left behind. And mm-hmm. That's a very important thing. And it's a kindness that we can give to people by looking at the good, if there is any, and there is in everybody something good. And I think that helps everyone if we focus on the good and just try to increase that. And I think that's really what makes the difference.
What about toxic people?
Well, okay, so let's talk about toxic people. Toxic people are, I think, people who are hurting. And so many people who are toxic, it's a cry for help. And instead of trying to isolate them, which can increase the toxicity, you know, if you ask them, why are you hurting? Can you talk to me about why are you, you know, what is it that is giving you this way of behaving? Or and then get behind not what you see, but what's behind what you see. I call it the iceberg effect. We only see the tip of the iceberg in most circumstances. But if you can get beneath it, then in many cases, for instance, you know, there'll be a situation where you'll see one particular emotion, but it's really not the emotion that is the biggest one. It's what's manifesting. And if you get to the deeper emotion, which feeds it, then you can actually resolve the problem. So many people are doing crying out for help for problems to be resolved. No one paid attention to me. I'm angry about that. I'm not taken seriously, so now I'm going to, you know, do something crazy so everybody will take me seriously. They're all cries for help in one way or another.
I know that there was, you know, I worked in the hospital for many years, that a lot of patients, you know, cancer patients would tell me they wish they would have risked more and cared less.
Well, that's a very common thing. Yeah. I think that's a hugely common thing because we like to live under the assumptive perspective that we'll have, you know, years and years to go on, and we all want to be able to get up and have that belief. But for many people with illnesses, and I spent my time, you know, 15 years working with people with HIV, AIDS, and Hep C, and hemophilia. That was the group that I was the national advocate for. One of the only gifts, certainly, that I got from working in that field for the time I did, and being with people who really were told, you know, you're not going to have a full life, at least at the time I was in the early phases of that work. And so they had to say, what's meaningful in life? What's important in life? What are the real things that are priorities for me? And, you know, putting your life in order of almost like, what's my real bucket list, you know? I mean, if I'm going to, and I actually asked a client one day, I said, you know, he's terminally ill, and I said, do you have a bucket list? And he went right into his pocket and put it right down in front of me. So my session went from that point to saying, okay, which ones are the most important and how can I help you accomplish them? So, mm-hmm. you know, in life, we don't often do that, but if we can prioritize what's important, what's really important, and then try to focus on those things, then no matter when we go, our lives will be far more fulfilled and far more meaningful. And I think that's what people really search for is, you know, how do I make purpose and meaning out of my life? That's the real big question for most of us, I think, at core.
Okay, and given your 15 years as an advocate for hemophilia, yep. HIV, and Hep C, yep. What made it possible for this disease community to seek justice and band together?
Well, that's an excellent question. I will say that people that saw injustice and knew that it had been done to them with knowledge and intent for money and profits, and just the horrific nature of the suffering, and that, you know, they had to say what is behind this, you know, what causes this horrific situation. So these people got together, people with severe disabilities, okay, got the truth in documents that they found. It were actually initially in a, it was there was a garbage dump, believe it or not, that they were trying to destroy documents, and this one attorney got some of those documents that showed cover-ups at the highest levels in the corporations, and even lax oversight by government regulatory bodies, and they started to really ask questions that they had never asked before. And started to uncover documents that showed that the best practices for them were going to cause their lives to be snuffed out early for things that were avoidable, and that at a certain point people knew were avoidable. And so then this group fought to get on the FDA oversight committees, which, by the way, I like to educate people to this. The vast majority of FDA oversight committees do not have end-user consumers sitting on them. They have people who are specialized in the various industries, and they have government officials, and those people, because of their credentials and experience, often go back and forth between private sector jobs and government oversight bodies. But I would, you know, the group that I worked with made sure that end-user folks, people who actually have the product that these corporations were making, this blood product, they were going to be sitting on those oversight groups, so that when questions of safety that impacted their lives were going to be addressed, they would be at the table, and they would hold the government officials and the industry people accountable for the best practices, so that the kind of things that went on that infected 10,000 U.S. citizens needlessly with HIV and Hep C, along with other probably bloodborne pathogens that have yet to be discovered, probably, that, you know, that 10,000 U.S. citizens who've been impacted adversely that way through their FDA-approved medicine, will not be repeated again. And that's what this group stood up for. And because the product, after it was dumped on U.S. citizens, was then shipped around the world to infect another 70,000 people globally. So, you know, tens of thousands of people were needlessly given lethal diseases for profit, because the regulatory failure was there, and the corporation's unwillingness to do what they could have done to prevent those infections once they were known was not implemented. And so that kind of lax oversight and the duty to warn, informed consent, do no harm, all major principles in science, good science and good medicine. You know, the hemophilia community said, you're going to be held accountable to these principles. And those are things I can get behind, and I hope everybody listening to this program, that they can get behind those principles too, and articulate them, and make sure that no matter where they are, whether it's a dialysis facility or whatever, that they say, well, okay, what are best practices? Are we doing those here? Are you listening to our voices? Are you taking input from the consumers? Is the care adequate? Those are all really critical questions, because, you know, people deserve to be treated with the utmost respect. And when that's not being done, the people that are not doing that, that are have the privilege of being caregivers, need to be to be taught to do it differently if that's not happening.
Well, this was the Ryan White's mother that started COT?
No. It was actually...
Okay.
It was let's get to the... So there, COT also, to be fair to your California... You're in California, and I know Californians that may be listening to this, I want to be fair to them. So the West Coast folks actually... COT came out of a group called PEER, which was a the COT then went from the PEER group out west to the East Coast in Massachusetts, where it actually formed and incorporated. Mm-hmm. And the two people that founded it was a guy named Jonathan Wadley and Tom Fahey, both of whom are now deceased, unfortunately. But Wadley was the name of the class, the suit that got brought forward in the class action suit that we did, which brought the people that were impacted, that were still surviving, and their families, $640 million, which, by the way, was taken away by the lawyers. I don't begrudge lawyers, but that's a nice chunk of change that I wish was in people's hands, but they wouldn't have been in their hands if there wasn't for the lawyers in part. And then they also were able to get a bill through law in the federal government and funded. It's called the Ricky Ray Law, and it's known now as Public Law 105-369. And that law gave $750 million to the people that were impacted. So it was over $1 billion that was able to come back into the impacted families. Now, I feel, you know, there's no price that one could ever put on anyone's life. Any one of the families that were impacted would say, I would give all my money back if you could bring back the life of my loved one. You know, the vast majority, I can't even think of anyone that wouldn't say that. And so when, you know, I'm not going to commodify life any more than I would want it done to me. But the reality is that the bigger win, not the legal win, not even the monetary win, the bigger win was that we now have raised consciousness through this in very important places with legislators, with people that work in the facilities, with the FDA. And so questions are now being asked before people move forward, and that they know that there's a group and that there are people that are educated about what happened, and we want to make sure it doesn't happen again. And you know, any place that's not being operated in an ideal way from best practices needs to be encouraged to move towards that. You know, whether it's mm-hmm. a hemophilia treatment center or whether it's a dialysis center, that there, you know, people need to realize that what is today does not have to be what is tomorrow. And if you want something better, then it's really a question of getting people together in these facilities across the country and creating support groups, and then holding people accountable that are doing the treating to be able to improve the nature of how it's done if it's not being done in an ideal way.
And what if the patients are fearful of retaliation, like getting terminated for complaining?
Right, exactly. So here's the point. People will have to make their own personal choices. The retaliation, I mean, we had a situation. Now, you couldn't, this would not be provable, but it's an interesting coincidence. Let's leave it at that. People could draw their own conclusions. In the midst of this work that we were doing, you know, product shortage started to occur. Now, one could say that that might have been intentional mm-hmm. or not, but certainly people who need a life-saving product, if people start saying there's shortages of it, right, you can create a false shortage if you want to. For, you know, you just to slow down your manufacturing process, right? And in that sense, a very, you know, power dynamic message to people, right? But mm-hmm. the point is that the consumer groups, even the ones that were on the opposite side of our named in the litigation, actually to the credit of the National Hemophilia Foundation, which people would be shocked that I gave them credit, but I'm going to, because when people do the right thing, I absolutely want to affirm it. Even though they were a named litigant with the firms that had the tainted medicine, when it came to slowing down product, they stood with us and said no. And actually the firm that was going to do some very, even some unethical things beyond the infecting, about eliminating options for consumers and stuff, and then even that group said, you're not welcome. One year said, you're not welcome to come to our national convention, which is where most people would seek out new customers. And so, right. when you take the risk, even groups that may be opposed to you initially or have be adversarial with you initially can be won over if you're persistent. And if you work with the people that are in those organizations to say, this is, you know, not just about having a salary, it's about having a life. And it's not just about one person standing up. It's about a whole group of us standing up, because it is hard. You're right. Absolutely, Arlene. One person stands up by themselves, they can be pushed out the door, okay? But if you mm-hmm. get everybody saying we're standing up together, then you if they try to retaliate on a group of people, that's news, right? That's that mm-hmm. becomes news. That becomes bad publicity. People then, you know, take notice, and people don't want to be known as the worst facility, right? That's not what people aspire to do. I'm the worst company. I'm the worst facility. I do the worst practices. No, people want to be known professionally and you know, just from a life satisfaction standpoint, as I'm doing the best I can. I'm doing things in the right way. And so you can get people who are retired in an industry that want to see it better before they go to the spirit realm. They say, "Gee, I wish it had been better, you know, when I was working there." And those people can then since they're retired, they're getting their paychecks. They're not going to be retired against, and they may be able to say things for consumers that they can't say for themselves.
We have a few of those that have come forward, yeah.
It's really important.
Yeah,
yeah, because if they've got the credentials, if they've got the experience, if they've been in the field, they can't be dismissed, right? And people are going to have to take them seriously. And, you know, the best way to improve a bad problem is to offer a better solution. So you can't throw stones at something and then not have something to say, okay, here's what we would do to make it better. I think that even with the firms that I was involved in the, you know, helping the consumers to litigate, I would go to them and I would say, I think these are things you can do better. And I would give them very concrete examples of improvements that these firms could make. And even though they may have seen me in an adversarial way, the reality is that I was actually trying to help them to be better corporate citizens. And I think if you approach it on that basis, it's very hard for them to say, you're against us. I'm saying I'm against doing substandard things. You know, if I think there's a better way to do it, it's on you to show me that I'm wrong. And that most people didn't want to take that challenge. But the mm-hmm. reality is that we can always put that gauntlet down. As long as we do our homework and we do it well, we can ask people to do better, and ask companies to do better, and ask the, you know, consumers to come together as a group. Again, this is the key to it. It's to do it as a group. Look, the hemophilia community with HIV/AIDS, when they first started to meet, they met secretly. They pulled the shades down. I mean, these were the days when they were talking about putting people on islands, or, you know, and isolating them. It was a very scary time, you know. But you had to get together. You had to say, how are we going to strategize? How are we going to do this as a group? And little groups all around the country got together, and then they got together through using the internet, through using publication, the Common Factor, and the Cot Canary, and a bunch of other things that we put out, that we got the information into hands of people and got them into chat rooms, and were able to have people communicating across the country. It's a rare disease. Remember, there's only 20,000 or so people with hemophilia in the United States, so it's classified as a rare disease. But these folks were able to connect using good technology and some of the old technology, and be educated, and then stand up and demand better from the government oversight bodies, from the treaters, from the manufacturers, and things are vastly improved today from where they were when COP was first started, because the consumers, not the experts, but average families and average citizens and even children got together and said, enough is enough, and we're not going to take it anymore. And as a result, wonderful things have transpired to make good for not just that community, but for all communities that need blood or blood products. And that's millions of Americans every year, and the largest group being cancer folks.
Well, what are some ways that someone can start their own advocate, to be their own advocate, or to advocate for loved ones? What's your
right.
advice on that?
Okay, so first is to ask the question is, what don't I like? If you're not, don't advocate if things are fine. Advocate if things aren't fine, right? So what don't I like? What or what could be better? That's the first question to ask. What do I think is not right, and what do I think could be better? And a good little and then are there other people that are getting services like I am that maybe what are they? What would they say to that question, right? What am I not getting? What's not right, and what could be better? Find out what that is, and then start regionally, and start to build little groups, and then those groups could cover states eventually, and then regions of the country, and then the whole country. But it has to start where you are. Nobody at the higher levels, frankly, will take you seriously. And the government certainly won't take you seriously unless you are a big enough entity to make an impact or have information that can get out to the wider public that will get them stirred up. And so, but I always, caution people to remember that the vast majority of people, even in the hemophilia community, were not COP members. They may have been sympathetic, but many of them were very quiet, okay, supporting behind the scenes. That really, in any social justice movement or advocacy movement, there's degrees of comfort. So, some people might have risked arrest at different things, and very few people, frankly, out of any group are going to be one of those people. But it certainly draws media attention, right? And so that's one level. Another would be, writing letters to oversight bodies, ethics bodies, to the corporations if the corporations are not doing things right. Figuring out who holds the power to make the change. That's a critical piece. If there's something wrong, what's wrong? What could be made better? And who has the power to make it better? So to get our bill into law in Congress, we had to look at the committees. We had to look at who's going to write our bill. We got to get some sponsors. So that can be done regionally at towns, town health departments, right? If you're dealing with nephrology groups, you could be saying, okay, what's the local group that nephrology people go to? What's the professional association? Can we have at a national conference of nephrologists a session where end users of dialysis talk about their experiences and what they feel could be improved, and that it's recorded. And then those little recordings can then be shared across the country, and then people, who are running those departments in medical ethics classes at colleges could be said, this is going to be a part of our course. We're going to look at this movie or this tape. There are ways to do these things. That everybody's got different talents. I often say that. What's your talent? What's the gift that you bring to the table? Not everybody has the same gift. So how you put that together to get what you need is key. In COT, we had a guy who I think is one of the unsung heroes of COT. His name was Michael Davon. Michael Davon was an MIT graduate. He was pulling in a very good salary with that background. But he used the background that he had to set up an entire internet system, which made it extremely easy for consumers in the hemophilia community to connect not just in the United States but around the world. And so that was a huge gift that he had, one person that he gave to the community. And you know, others gave the gift of writing books and articles. You know, Corey Dubin, who's still around, and as far as I know, is still the board chair of COT. He has a radio program out in California. Some of your listeners may even know about it, Coyote Radio. So he was able to, you know, use his media contacts effectively. So the real question is, you know, who do I know, and what do I bring? And then looking at the need and then saying who has the best capability of meeting that need. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I was going to ask you also is how important is it to understand the conflict of interest about, you know, which healthcare is administered here in the United States?
Right. I absolutely. That is, so here's the point. If you're going to do what's best, right, you mm-hmm. have to own your conflict of interest. So people who are in the medical profession, when they give presentations, professional presentations, if they're doing it in the best way, the people that speak acknowledge before any slide goes up or PowerPoint goes forward, the conflict of interest I have in doing this research is the following, right? That's mm-hmm. standard procedure for people in science and industry to acknowledge before they do research, here's my bias, here's who funds me. So if people are not willing to disclose that, then there's probably something to hide. And I think that that's the important piece. If before a person, you know, you own that piece. So I was trained that in seminary. You know, in seminary, my professors were adamant to get across to me as a in my theological education that I own my own stuff before I do any kind of preaching to anybody else or even teaching to anybody else. I have to say, you know, my background is the following. Here's my biases, and then present whatever I'm going to present, and that way I have integrity. But to think that nobody has any biases or conflict of interest is a fool's game. It's not true. We are all biased in one way or another, if nothing else, just from our life experiences. It's only going to give us one slice of life. And if we're going to have integrity as people, we have to own our limitations. And studies that don't do that are not good studies. If you're, you know, going to say your science is on your side, then you better do it in the scientifically best practices way. And if it's less than that, then you need to own it. You know, if it's a small research cohort, you could say, well, this is just a small pilot program of only a few people. You can't draw general conclusions. That's the honest mm-hmm. thing to do. That's the integrity that I think everyone needs to demand out of people that are claimed to be serving people in the right way. Otherwise, we by our apathy and by our inaction, we get things that are not really what we want. So it's really a choice. If you do nothing, then what is will be the norm, and it might even get worse. But if you do something, it can get better.
And what steps can one take to hold doctors, insurance companies, and treatment facilities accountable for their actions?
Right. So here's the first thing is to get knowledge, right? So what's mm-hmm. on the books? What are they being held to now, right? Getting mm-hmm. conversant with that is critical. You have to know before you advocate. You have to, you know, I learned in many ways that I could prove things by getting informed. So good example, in hemophilia area in blood safety, the people would say, well, if you take away the blood shield laws, which make it, they put a statutory bar on litigation for anything bad with blood or blood products, so that if you get harmed, there's a time limit on which you can litigate. And I say, well, if you take those away, the hospitals and doctors won't be able to function, right? So mm-hmm. I did the professor up in Vermont did some research with one of her students, and wonderful gift of hers to the hemophilia community. And she looked at the blood shield laws in all the states across the country. And it happens that in Vermont, up until the 1990s, there were no shield laws up there. You know, statutory limitations, and there were hospitals that didn't go broke, doctors didn't lose their practices. So you know, people could put up a straw dog argument that stops progress. But if you do your homework, you could say, geez, if this problem existed in the 80s and the place didn't even state didn't even implement these things until the 90s, and by golly, you know, these hospitals still exist and these doctors didn't lose their practices, it's a fallacious mm-hmm. argument. It's an argument that's a lazy person's excuse for an inability or a lack of desire to change the norm. But if you're a harmed party, you want to change that norm. But the first thing you have to do is know, can I prove that the things that are going to come back at me are inaccurate? Can I give you an example where this thing didn't exist and everything functioned fine? So why are you making an unnecessary argument about this? And where's the incentive, which is what I always put, is where's the incentive to keep things the way they are? If it's just to make money and to cover your mistakes, that's not a good reason. If it's to because you're unsure about something going forward that it could be more harmful, I'm willing to look at that. But you have to first know, okay, so what are the guidelines of a dialysis center? What are the standards of care that are expected? Are people
there
being
are
held
none.
Accountable? Well, that's a big problem. That has
there are none. There is no accountability.
Yeah, that's
it
the
is,
Wild
and
West.
It's been the Wild West, and it's been costing lives. And the part that gets me, John, is every patient who's been harmed, terminated, Medicare has known about it and
well,
has
so,
done nothing. And
right.
so,
it, so
that's
here's
brutal.
The no, but that's a, but okay. So if their adverse reactions or deaths or harms are there, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And they've
then,
known about them.
Then, okay, so my first question would be, especially if it's Medicare, which is what you're saying, I would, you know, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the government agencies that oversee that, HHS, Department of Health and Human Services, whichever bodies it is that are directly responsible to quality health care. For instance, hospitals, many of them are CAR for JCO accredited. And so the accrediting agencies, right, can be brought into this.
No, they're freestanding. They don't fall under JCO.
No JCO?
They're no JCO. Just if
well, why not?
If they're in a hospital. You know, it's to the point where the government has known. We had sanitarians in 2000 where they found the patients at risk, the network not doing their job, which they have their own oversight. So if a patient goes...
Well, who's
to
they?
Right,
who's the oversight?
CMS.
Okay,
CMS
so it
allowed this industry to form ESRD network and for them to have provisions to be able to compete and be authorized, they have to also be on... They also have their own oversight, and if a patient goes to civil rights, if a patient goes to ADA, if a patient goes anywhere, it goes back to their own oversight, and that is why I call it the circle of violence that this has been
right.
continuing.
Okay, so
no
what?
Sanctions.
Right. So what has to happen then? If there are really two approaches to this, the only two that I can think of right off the cuff here.
Okay.
And one would be to work with the existing body to implement a much stronger regulatory thing within the existing network. In other words, give it some teeth, the existing one. Or the other is to mandate an additional entity, create and mandate an additional entity that would
right.
be an oversight body. So if the one will not allow itself to be transformed to be more accountable for better outcomes, then it, the new agency needs to be given the consent by the operating authority, whichever regulatory authority that would be,
right,
to become involved in the process of holding people accountable for good outcomes, and that you know, you've got to create benchmarks. So my point would be, first would be to find out how, in hemophilia, what we had was something called a universal notification system, and mm-hmm. whenever there was an
yeah.
adverse reaction, you know, people could report it in. And so it's not unlike, and I hate to use this example, it's not certainly the best example, and I'm acknowledging that. But if in the criminal industry with drug dealing, there was a program called Drop a Dime. It was a program where people could literally call in on a criminal activity regarding narcotics to a civilian that would be in the precinct that would monitor that call along with the police department. And all of a sudden, accountability in terms of enforcement on prosecuting drug dealers jumped.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, not every police department is in cahoots with the criminal world, but there were bad apples in every profession there are. And this was a way of making sure that those people wouldn't be operating the system, because the majority of people were decent people, and that this ensured decency from the standpoint of follow up for people that wanted to have better communities. And so, to me, a end user, somebody from your group or an organization that could be a monitoring agency that would get the complaints coming in, and then say, okay, this facility in this place seems to be having a lot of problems, and what are we going to do about it? And then to say, we need to make sure that these people that are reporting can be doing it anonymously, but if they can identify with a coded identifier, then that is a way that they can say that your facility has 10, 20, 30, 40, however many problems that have been communicated to us by encoded way. We're not telling you who these people are, but they're definitely using your facility. They're not going to close the whole facility and throw everybody out. Now, if they did that, that would be news. Okay,
right.
That would be big news. You know, facility closes due to consumer complaints against quality of services. Now, you know, that's not what you want as a corporation. You want, this is the greatest facility in the world, and you ought to come here, right? And if we do things right, we can do it on that basis.
Well, the thing is the way the whole system in dialysis is set up, it if you have only two main companies, you know, because they bought everybody else out.
Yeah, then you have to foster competition or make one of them
the
better
company.
Well, yeah,
but they own it, and sometimes they own all the clinics in town. So when a patient is terminated, they can't go to any of them at all. And
okay, so
it
so
does
here's,
not serve yeah. it does not serve the patient, because the networks know these patients are being terminated or in the process of termination, but they do not contact the patient and try to resolve the issues. They let them get terminated, and they do not help them find places to go. It does not serve self-policing. It does not serve it serves itself. So when you have two companies that are running into major areas or major state, those people own the oversight.
Right, except
that's where the danger is.
Yeah, Arlene, I agree. Okay, so here's, it reminds me all too much of monopolistic stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, a good lawyer could look at monopolistic stuff and say, are these two companies colluding with each other? That would, if there are only two companies, then the question are they colluding for you know, least expense to this population and most profit for us? If that's what they're doing,
right.
then it's not, I'd be interested to look at the antitrust situation. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, can't do law,
they're
can't
immune
give advice
from,
that way.
They're immune from the anti-kickback and Stark law. This is the only group of physicians that are. So what happens is these nephrologists go into business with the for-profits. And who owns the prescription pad? What we're finding is the cheaper the care, the more profit for the investors and the chairs.
Right. So, okay, I get that. Here's one of the things you could do that it may be an interesting thing to do, but it's counterintuitive, but I know that we'd used it with one of the firms that we litigated. We actually bought stock shares. One person did anyway. And they went to a shareholders meeting. And, they had to be heard because they own, if it's a publicly traded corporation, I don't know.
I've thought about that. I really thought about that.
Well, it's worked in other things and divestiture movements. So, I mean, I started this conversation with you a little bit about talking about working on, anti-apartheid work when there was apartheid in South Africa. And the divestiture movement across the campuses of the United States helped bring about the change that we have in South Africa today. So, people may not think they have a way, but for instance, your largest pension fund in the United States is TIAA CREF, which is held by the teachers. I think most teachers are pretty ethical people. And if they found, we've got X amount of shares from this company and, we can make a shareholder's resolution from our stock holdings that either you're going to do these things or we're going to withdraw shares and we're going to invest elsewhere, and they'll go to their knees, or try to foster competition between those two companies. Say, look, one of you is going to survive, the other one of you is going to go out of business. Now, obviously, most people would love to be the only game in town. That would be a true monopoly, but nobody really wants to be put out of business. I don't want to put people out of business. I don't want to make people unemployed. What I'd like to do is foster what is supposed to be about in America, foster some real competition. Now, the other thing is true in hemophilia. A lot of these guys that were infected started their own home care companies. They got entrepreneurial. They said, rather than having other people care for us that don't know a damn thing about our disease because it's a rare disease or don't have an idea how the hemophilia culture works in terms of the disease, there's also a culture there. And so, we're going to create our own businesses. We're going to get our own pharmacists. We're going to get our own doctors. And we'll create our own home care companies. And we'll take care of ourselves. Now, people... I know somebody right now that is not poor by any stretch of the imagination, who has kidney issues. Okay, and that individual, if I were able to really educate him about the positive changes, he might actually create a corporation that could compete with these guys. There are people that are in your community. I'm sure that have means somewhere. Kidney failure happens across the board in terms of, and so there are people that have had kidney issues and have experienced some of the horrors that you're talking about in less than ideal circumstances, and they may not make it in some cases, and we know that. But they could put in their will, in my will, I want to put something towards creating an agency that changes the way things were done to me. And they could hold fundraising events. They could go to private foundations and corporations that are, serving the community. See, you may have just these dialysis centers, but there's a whole, I can't imagine that there are not companies that make medications related to kidney issues. And then who are they? And, can people say, we'd like to have you support the consumers here. So there are ways to do this, but you have to plan it step by step. And just had its anniversary for 25 years, not that long ago. And it wasn't overnight that we accomplished what we were able to accomplish. It took years. So, you know, when people are sick and dying, and like they were with HIV/AIDS in the early days, it wasn't easy. We lost a lot of our board members, and I'm sure, you know, people going into kidney failure and on dialysis aren't always healthy either, and it's hard. It's really hard, but it doesn't mean that it's not something that's worth pursuing. In fact, if it's going to be better and easier, somebody's got to pursue it at some point, and why not right. now?
Well, that's what we're setting up to do. My last question, I've really enjoyed this tonight.
Oh, me too. Thank you for the opportunity. It's been an
well,
honor.
Well, yeah, it's just like talking to an old friend.
Well, you are an old friend.
But it's so much information, you know. But how does one not get burnout or and severe, you know, and being depressed doing this work, the advocacy?
Okay. It's a simple question to answer from my standpoint. Half the care goes to you before you give it to somebody else. If you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to be good for anybody else. So when you notice that more than half of the time is being spent on helping others and not at least half the time being spent on yourself, it's unbalanced and it's not going to be sustainable. And also to not just look at the problems, celebrate the victories. If you have a victory in any way, shape, or form, celebrate it. Look, it's got to be fun for people to stay involved. People have to have some joy, have to have some happiness, have to have some celebratory times. I think it's every year for any nonprofit, you need one event to get everybody together to celebrate what you've done in the year. And creating even small celebrations for small victories is so important. And to remember that it's not on one person's shoulders, it's on the group's shoulders. So you don't get burned out if you spread the weight. You can, a few people with just a few fingers can lift a whole person, but one person alone is going to be hard to lift the other person. So
could
if we all put our hands
the
together.
Sheep? Hit me.
That's the other thing that's true, is that I use a metaphor which I think is very helpful, which is that at best, the best that any of us can do is to be a sheepdog, and to the good sheepdog, and I have a sheepdog, when they do their job well, they bring the sheep to the shepherd. And you don't get confused between the sheepdog and the shepherd. And that's really important. We're all fallible human beings. None of us are perfect. But there is a perfect source, a higher power, God, as I would call the higher power, but other people would call it different things. And that's the source that you need to sustain yourself. I couldn't do this work without being a spiritual person. There's no way. I would be toast a long time ago. But I recognize that the only way I can sustain myself is to look to the shepherd and to recognize my place isn't being the shepherd, it's being the sheepdog and trying to make sure that I know where that shepherd is when I'm looking for the sheep.
Well, that it says a lot. John, I've really enjoyed this. Carol was unable to do the show tonight.
Well, I'm glad you were able to do it.
Yeah,
okay?
Me too. I mean, I'm like, what?
Well, we all get surprises. That's part of life.
Yeah. But, and I just want to thank you because it's always been refreshing. And I always come back and come away from every time I talk to you with much more wisdom than when I started.
Well, I'm encouraged by you, Arlene, and knowing that you're out there and knowing that you care deeply about the well-being of people across this country and that you're caring about your own well-being because I'm sure there's a lot of those people who are saying, Arlene, are you taking care of yourself too? And you don't want to get them all worried. So that's why we need a lot of those people that may be listening to this call to say, hey, Arlene, how can I help? I got some skills. And, you know, if you get a hold of Arlene and dialysis advocates, you know, I think it's going to be a way of making it easier for everybody. The more people that come together to get the job done, the easier it is for everybody.
Okay, John. Well, we're going to be inviting you back again, and I wish to thank you for the show tonight. I think that everybody came away with something.
Yeah, and thank you.
It was really heartfelt.
Yep. Well, lots of love to you and to everybody that you and I know in common. And thanks for this opportunity. And I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.